journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, April 26, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and
think. It just makes me stop and think.
It just makes me stop and think.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The Supreme Court hears arguments on Arizona's SB 1070. Acclaimed LA artist Judy Baca joins us to discuss a new local exhibit called Urban Legends and a look at the biggest student uprising you've never heard of happening in Montreal.
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments for and against Arizona's controversial immigration law, SB 1070, yesterday, 2 years and 2 days after it was signed into law by Arizona Governor Jan Brewer. The justices listened to 80 minutes of oral argument from attorneys representing both sides of Arizona versus the United States. Justice Elena Kagan recused herself from the case in December due to her previous position as Solicitor General under President Obama during the national furor over the law, leaving only 8 justices to issue a ruling that will have a major impact on the future of immigration law throughout the nation. Following the passage of SB 1070 in 2010, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Utah, and Indiana passed similarly tough immigration laws, most of which face legal challenges. At the close of arguments yesterday, observers felt the justices were leaning toward allowing at least some of SB 1070's controversial provisions to stand after an appeals court enjoined them in 2010, pending the higher court's review. At one point during the arguments, liberal Justice Sotomayor told the attorney representing the government that one of his arguments was, quote, not selling. At another swing vote, Justice Kennedy seemed to agree that unauthorized immigration caused, quote, social and economic disruption. The Supreme Court will rule on 4 provisions: the requirement that local law enforcement check the citizenship status of people they stop for any offense, the legalization of arrest without warrant of anyone suspected of being in the country illegally, the establishment of a state crime for undocumented people to seek work, and establishing a state crime to prosecute undocumented immigrants while requiring non-citizens to carry immigration documents to present upon demand. The Obama administration is arguing that Arizona's law infringes on the powers of Congress and the executive branch to, respectively, make and implement immigration law. The court may strike down some provisions while upholding others. My guest is Roberto Rodriguez, a professor in the Department of Mexican-American Studies at the University of Arizona. Welcome to Uprising, Roberto.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. The last time we had you on our program, we were discussing the book ban in Arizona, and certainly Arizona's law SB 1070, which is at stake here, is only one aspect of the many multi-pronged assaults on immigrants and people of immigrant descent in Arizona. But let's look at this Supreme Court decision that is pending in a broader context. Much is at stake here. How important is this Supreme Court decision when it comes?
Well, I would frame it in a little different way, and it's okay in the sense that other, you know, people will see things differently. I happen to be from a school, so to speak, that sees this not so much as a tax on immigrants, but a tax on indigenous peoples. You know, we're talking about peoples. You know, think, when you think about racial profiling, which is in effect the entire argument. Sometimes people say, oh, they target Hispanic-looking people. But when you really boil it down, they're not targeting people with blonde, blue eyes, or green eyes. The racial profile is indigenous. And so for us, you know, in Arizona, the Southwest, it don't matter where we are, we know what that profile is. And so it's to us, it's an insult to even debate it in those terms. Because what I've always seen it as Indian removal. And this is simply the latest. Now, part of that mindset, so to speak, is that I don't recognize the authority of the Supreme Court. And what I mean by that, I mean, if we're adept at politics, we know what this is about. I mean, we have a 5-4 conservative majority. They rule on whatever they want. It's not really about the law. It's whatever they say is the law. In this case, as you know, it's one of the liberal justices has recused herself. So we're talking about, at best, you know, if you had a swing vote in our side, it'd be 4-4, mm-hmm. meaning it would the law would stand. So,
and what do you make of this recusement by Elena Kagan? I mean, it's not the kind of thing that I imagine any of the conservative justices might do if they were ever, you know, accused of having a conflict of interest.
Yeah, no, they probably would try to profit from it somehow. You know, either that or their families. But I think, yeah, you hit it right on the nose. But, I mean, we can't do anything about that other than we can see it with our own eyes. Yes, she recuses herself, but if the situation reversed, I doubt it because it's never really happened. And we have people on record. But it's beyond the issue of immigration, meaning the record I'm referring to is that this Supreme Court is clearly intent on making the rich richer. And anything that they can do towards that end, you know, whether it's exploitation of workers, women, whatever, it's already there.
And when you say that, do you mean that basically making workers even more vulnerable by holding their immigration status over them will profit corporations?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. See, the best, I mean, this is big business. Human trafficking is bigger business than drug trafficking. And so I think we've seen it all along the border. You know, it's good for business and people profit.
Well, just to play devil's
enforcement.
Just to play devil's advocate on this issue of corporations benefiting, there was a law in Arizona that penalized businesses for hiring undocumented immigrants that actually the Supreme Court did uphold last year.
Yeah.
Well,
no, there may be exceptions here and there around the country. I'm saying on the whole, most of the Supreme Court decisions usually favor the exploitation of workers, regardless of color. And in most cases, they're going to side with corporations, as we know. Corporations are people, too, now. This is part of a wider pattern. And you mentioned Arizona and the book ban and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why I say for us, it's bigger than immigration. And in a sense, racial profiling is a little closer. It isn't so much a immigration issue, even though we're all paying attention to the provisions and who's making faces and, you know, who's making which kind of arguments. But in the end, what we live in Arizona, you know, people will tell you all along the border that this is what we've lived our entire lives, subject by or to the racial profiling of the federal government, meaning the Border Patrol, you know, ICE and all that. But what the danger in all of that is now we're supposed to give permission to police departments, which already happens with 287G,
right,
with secure communities and on and on.
And these are federal programs. And in
exactly.
This particular case, it's the federal government that is essentially on the attack against SB 1070, not as much in terms of what they think Arizona can and can't do, but more in terms of whose authority is at stake, the federal government's authority to deport immigrants versus the state's authority.
Precisely. In other words, we don't see this as nirvana. If we were to win, because it is, it's almost like a competition as to who can racially profile. It's the federal government that, you know, I think most of us know. There's been, 1.2 million deportations. And like I said, the very nature of ICE is racial deportation. So the struggle is to who can racially profile, the states or the federal government.
I want to play for you and our listeners,
sure,
an excerpt of Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, who,
yes,
spoke yesterday just after the Supreme Court hearing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the questions and the responses, just as far as federal rights, Arizona sovereignty, that we do have a responsibility to do what we can. I feel that they gave, and the comments were made that that Arizona has a right, and I, as governor, I felt was somewhat ensured that I had a right to protect the citizens of Arizona. I am. I do believe that this is an election year, and I believe that it was staged at the time that they knew that this was coming up, and they're playing to the Latino community, and they're trying to use that scare card, if you will, to generate a support for elections.
And that is Arizona Governor Jan Brewer commenting to press after the Supreme Court hearing. The actual decision is still pending, and it's over the law SB 1070 in the case Arizona versus the United States. A couple of things that she said here, Roberto. One is she talked about protecting her responsibility in protecting the citizens of Arizona. And then, of course, essentially claiming that what's happening around SB 1070 is an election year ploy that is playing to the Latino vote. How do you respond?
Well, again, ICE and the Border Patrol have existed from, you know, probably 100 years or so.
In different forms.
Perhaps for some people it's politics, but we live it all the time, every day. I'm going to put this in perspective in terms of Arizona. In, I believe it was 2 weeks before SB 1070 passed. In other words, it was not a law, contended or otherwise. It was not in the books yet. 2 weeks before, 800 federal agents from throughout, all these different federal agencies and state and local, descended upon South Tucson, conducted this massive military raid, and they, I think, arrested about 20 shuttle bus operators. So, in other words, this is not about SB 1070. We're already living that. We've all been living that. You know, that's why I say this is a competition between the states versus the federal government as to who can racially profile. You know what? We don't really have, when people talk about comprehensive immigration, at least it's in the right direction. That is, what we need in this country is a policy that puts first and foremost the human being into the equation. You see, something like NAFTA, all the NAFTA type things, CAFTA, you know, all of them, those would be okay if human beings were in the equation. The problem that the most of us have is that human beings are outside of that equation, so that capital, goods, ideas, everything can flow back and forth except human beings. So that's kind of the right idea, but of course it's not implemented by people that are friendly, so to speak. It's a corporate. Everything is corporate. You know, those laws are designed to maximize profit while super exploiting human beings. And until we deal with that, because, you know, I think most of us know the Zapatistas rose up precisely because of NAFTA, warning the world that their way of life would end if NAFTA was implemented. You know, what, 20 years later, and now we have 6 million people that have migrated because the genetically modified corn, you know, subsidized by the U.S. government, goes south and the people go north. You know, there's no accidents here. It's all related. And until we do that, you know, and of course, we're playing this out at the Supreme Court right now. And in the end, what's really going to happen? That's not going to solve anything. Because, again, if the federal government were to somehow win, which I doubt, but if they were, all those policies remain, you know, and you know, it's ridiculous. If you live in Arizona, the Border Patrol, you think they were the Boy Scouts. They're everywhere. I mean, you can't turn around without seeing a Border Patrol vehicle. You know, we have the fences now. We have the militarization. That's not going to end, even if the federal government wins against the state of Arizona.
Well, Roberto Rodriguez, I want to thank you very much for joining us again.
Yeah, thank you.
Roberto Rodriguez is a professor in the Department of Mexican American Studies at the University of Arizona, and we've been discussing the Supreme Court's arguments, or rather hearing, with arguments for and against Arizona's controversial immigration law, SB 1070. There were 80 minutes of arguments from attorneys representing both sides of the case, Arizona versus the United States. With Justice Elena Kagan having recused herself, there's a possibility of a very rare 4-4 split split in the court. If there is a tie, the law is most provisions of the law that have already been blocked by a lower court would stand. However, a tie would not settle the constitutionality of Arizona being able to, and in general other states being able to pass such laws rather than the federal government. This is Uprising, and we will continue to cover the story of the Supreme Court's decision on SB 1070 in the following weeks and months. After this short break, we'll take a look at the largest student uprising you've never heard of. It's happening in Montreal in Canada. And then later in the hour, Judy Baca, a legendary street artist, will join us in studio along with Estria, a graffiti artist and creative director of the Estria Foundation, to tell us about an exhibit happening here in LA called Urban Legends. Stay tuned.
KPFK presents An Evening with Van Jones, civil rights and environmental activist and former Obama White House Green Jobs advisor. Van Jones will be signing copies of his new book, Rebuild the Dream, Thursday, April 26th at 6 p.m. at the Pasadena All Saints Church, 132 North Euclid Avenue in Pasadena. Proceeds benefit KPFK Radio 90.7 FM. More details at kpfk.org or contact the front desk at 818-985-2711.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. What started in late May with a quarter of a million people taking to the streets of Montreal in what may have been Canada's largest ever protest has now grown to encompass environmentalists, high school students, social justice activists, and more. Hundreds of people have been arrested as college students across Quebec have been on strike against a protest against a 75% tuition increase over 5 years. To date, nearly 200,000 college and university students remain on strike, mostly in the city of Montreal, but also at a smaller scale throughout the province of Quebec. The Canadian government's initial response was to ignore the protesters and claim that the tuition increase was unavoidable. But as the strike has continued, stronger tactics have caught the government's attention. These include disruptive tactics, including barricading government buildings, shutting down the local subway through the use of smoke bombs, and throwing bricks onto rail lines. Police have routinely used pepper spray, concussion grenades, and batons, leading to many injuries and even one protester losing an eye when a flashbang exploded close to his face. Students also targeted a development summit last week when Quebec's premier, Jean Charest, spoke. Charest told the press that his government has twice, quote, extended our hand to students for negotiations. He added, I find it unacceptable that one student association refused to condemn violence. This week, negotiations between the education minister, Lynn Bouchon, and representatives from some of the student groups involved in the strike broke down. The 48-hour meeting began on Monday but ended sooner than expected after Bouchon pulled out, saying that one of the student groups, CLASS, had violated a 48-hour ceasefire on actions. Joining me on the phone now, live from Canada, is Leo Bureau Bluin, who is the president of the FECQ, one of the major student organizations involved. Also, Stephanie Claremont, a reporter with CKUT Community Radio in Montreal, who has been extensively covering the student strike. And Lillian Radovic, writer, activist, and doctoral candidate at McGill University, where she recently led a successful campaign to unionize lecturers. She wrote about the Quebec strike. Welcome to Uprising, Leo, Stephanie, and Lillian.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi.
Let me start, Leo, with you. Tell us, first of all, to our American audience who haven't heard much about this major strike, what is the reason why so many hundreds of thousands of students are out protesting in Montreal and across Quebec?
Well, in Quebec, which is a Canadian province, university education is quite affordable since about 40 years. To give you an example, the tuition fee here for 1 year of universities are about $3,000. And it's very important for Quebecers because for us, it gives the chance to every kid to attend university, even for people which are not rich. But Quebec's government announced that they wanted to hike tuition fees of 75% in 5 years. And we are concerned that this is going to block access to universities for poor people or people from the middle class that don't have access to governmental bursaries. So that's why since about 2 months, Almost 200,000 students are on strike across Quebec. It's about half of the college and university students in the province. So it's really the biggest student strike of all of our history.
And can you tell us what happened earlier this week? There are conflicting reports about the meeting between Education Minister Lynn Bouchon and student organization representatives. The education minister said that a sort of ceasefire was violated before the 48-hour meeting was up and pulled out over the inclusion of one particular student group that's seen as the most militant class, it's called. And then the other student groups, I understand, pulled out, accusing the education minister of sabotaging the talks. How do you explain what happened?
Yeah, it's quite a weird situation right now in Quebec because we are on strike since 11 weeks. And Quebec's government, since this week, was refusing to meet with the student union to negotiate and to find solution. We finally had a meeting the day before yesterday with Quebec's government, but one of the conditions was to respect the ceasefire, a truce. But there was a kind of violent protest that occurred the day before yesterday, and the Quebec government said that it was organized by one of the student unions that negotiated with Quebec's government, but it was not organized by that student union. It was organized by one particular college that decided to make that protest. So we think it was only a pretext for Quebec's government to use the divide and conquer strategy and to eject one of the student union. So in solidarity, we decide to suspend the discussion for an undetermined period of time. And we are right now in discussion with the government to know how can we continue the negotiation, because it's really a long strike, and each day that passes is a day that compromises the semester of thousands of students. And that's why we hope that Quebec's government is going to change their attitude. We think the Quebec's government did that move because there are a lot of election rumors right now in our province, and we think that the government could use that social crisis for future elections.
I want to bring Lillian Radovic into the conversation. You wrote an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education called "The Biggest Student Uprising You've Never Heard Of." And this is a mass student strike now in its 11th week, with hundreds of thousands of students that are not attending classes in protest of the 75% student hike, fee hike over 5 years. Here in the state of California, our students are very familiar with rising tuition costs and have had many actions over many years. Why is it, Lillian, that American media, you think, hasn't covered this strike?
Well, I think there are probably a couple of reasons, at least. And one, as I write about in my article for the Chronicle, is simply that you have a language barrier. That's not 100% of justification, but that's partially it. Quebec is a French-speaking province, a predominantly French-speaking province, and the student movement is functions very independently here in Quebec, largely because of language issues. So you don't necessarily have the activist or academic links to the rest of North America, to English-speaking North America, that you might in other parts. The second reason, of course, is a sort of traditional and historic tendency on the part of American media outlets to focus inward, to really not look beyond its own borders. This isn't just true of the Quebec student strike, but of course, it's student movements often outside of continental North America, certainly because Puerto Rico has been central, Chile, the United Kingdom, and so forth. So one thing that's been very important for me, and I know for a number of other activists and supporters here, has been working to get the word out and working particularly to emphasize that there is a very strong link between what we are doing here in the province of Quebec in Canada and the fights that are happening in the CUNY system, for example, in New York City, certainly in California with the state college system there. And as you rightly say, that is a fight that's been going on now for years. It's the privatization of public education worldwide. Mm. And the more that we know about each other's fights, the stronger we will be. So I hope, and I thank you for actually taking the time to cover this, because we need to get the word out, and particularly now because we're at a crucial moment in the negotiations mm-hmm. here in Quebec, and the government is trying to divide and conquer the student movement. And the most important thing right now is solidarity, and knowing that we have solidarity outside is crucial.
I want, before I turn to our third guest, Stephanie Claremont, who is a reporter who's been covering this, I want to turn back to Leo Bureau-Bluin, who is the president of the FECQ. I know you have to leave soon for a press conference, but can you tell us what you think may happen? Because the government, at least press reports are saying that the government will not negotiate away from these planned tuition increases, and your organization and others, I understand, are not going to back down either, and are even calling for the resignation of the Premier Jean Charest. Can you tell us what you think will happen in the next few weeks?
I think that both parties should look for a compromise because the strike cannot last for a month or two, because some semester would be canceled and it would have major social and economic impact. And so I think that we both should look for a compromise. Another student group offered some seats on their delegation for the class to be able to negotiate with Quebec government, because Quebec government refused to meet the militant student group you talked about. So another student group that is similar to mine offered their seats to make sure that all the student unions were represented. But so right now we are continuing our pressure on the office of the Minister of Education in Quebec to make sure that we can find solutions. So I think that we should continue our discussion with Quebec's government to look for a solution. But it's a quite complex situation. It really concerns me the kind of divide and conquer strategy of Quebec's government, because it's a long, long strike, and it's like if Quebec's government was not concerned about the fact that it's a whole generation that is spending right now for their future, and Quebec's government seems to be concerned by that, and it really concerned me not only as a student but as a citizen. So that's why we invite our members to continue to strike and to fight, because I think it's now an important fight for our generation.
Well, Leo, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure.
Leo Bureau-Bluin is president of the FECQ, which is one of the several student organizations that are leading the student strike. I want to welcome to the program Stephanie Claremont, a reporter with CKUT Community Radio in Montreal, who's been extensively covering the student strike. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before I ask you a question, I want to play an excerpt of one of the reports that you did from the April 20th action in front of where the Quebec Premier Jean Charest was speaking.
Okay, there's a bunch of people who seem to be there for the Plan Nord Congress, a bunch of riot cops who are in a direct confrontation with people who are in some stairs. We're in the hall. Someone is down on the floor in the middle of some riot cops. And she seems to be hurt. She's down on the floor. Oh, and riot cops are hitting students.
Stephanie, paint a picture for our listeners of what the streets of Montreal have been like now for nearly 3 months. This is the 11th week of these protests. What has it looked like, felt like, sounded like?
They have looked and felt very vibrant and alive. I think that what's happening right now is a very radical transformation of the way that people think about politics, young people, I mean, because this is a lot of young people who are involved in this movement. And it's one thing to talk about politics in classrooms, but what's happened now is that this debate, which is centered around the right to access to school, has been taken to the streets in the most creative ways. I've seen so many amazing, such an amazing diversity of actions going on in the streets, from huge masses of people walking together, people of all age groups, but also things like the Red Square, which is the symbol of the strike, which has been put all over town. You can see the Red Square in the most original places. There's a mountain that's the main park where people go on walks on the Sundays here in Montreal. And one day some people had put little red eggs, because it was Easter, from the bottom all the way up to the top of the mountain. And on each one there was a different amount of money, and it was rising all the way to the top of the mountain until the number that this tuition hike would reach. And so a bunch of very original actions like that. Now, since the government has been extremely stubborn and just completely refusing to even sit down with the representatives from the different student associations, there's a lot of pressure that's mounting, and the actions have been starting for the past week or maybe a couple of weeks to be more full of rage. And
I want to bring Lillian Radovic back into the conversation. But before I do that, another excerpt of a CKUT report that featured Jaggi Singh, a well-known community activist from Montreal who participated in a roundtable on CKUT Community Radio about the student strike, commenting on how the demands of students fit into a broader context for economic justice.
Well, the demand for getting rid of the tuition hikes is a very specific demand to students, but it's a microcosm of a broader battle against neoliberalism. If you look at the message, the placards, the signs, what people were saying during the large demonstration on March 22nd, it wasn't simply we want lower tuition and get rid of this hike. It wasn't simply also free tuition. It was a broader fight back against neoliberalism. People who are 25 or under have basically lived under neoliberalism, basically lived under this agenda of privatization, of service fees, of basically user pay. And, you know, might not be familiar with this whole battle that took place in the 60s and 70s and 80s against the entrenchment of neoliberalism. For many of the community groups that are supporting the students, that are participating in the demonstrations, that are lending tangible solidarity, we see this not simply as incidental to the struggles that we engage in day to day, but as something that is part and parcel of the battles that we've been fighting for a decade and that some groups have been fighting for many decades.
Jaggi Singh participating in a community radio roundtable about the student strike in Montreal. I want to bring Lillian Radovic back into the conversation. You're a writer and activist, and you yourself have been involved in unionizing campaigns. You've written about this Quebec strike, and many are now referring to what's happening in Montreal as the Quebec Spring, harkening back to last year's Arab revolutions, most notably in Tunisia and Egypt. Given what Jaggi Singh just said about this being a broader fight against neoliberalism, do you also agree that this could transform what's happening from a student strike to a broader struggle across the province?
I think the potential for that is absolutely there. One thing I want to say is that as extraordinary as the events of the last few months have been, and they really have been extraordinary, this is actually part of a much longer student movement in Quebec. For example, in 2005, there was also a massive student strike to oppose the elimination of student bursaries. That was, by the way, successful, and the numbers were not dissimilar to what we're seeing now. That being said, I think that what needs to happen is that those connections need to be made with community organizations, and particularly with the labor unions. And this is where I hope the labor unions in Quebec have been very supportive of the student strike and of their goals. However, I think they need to be much more out front, not in terms of taking over the movement, because that's the last thing they need to do, but in terms of helping to coordinate their own members. And Quebec has the highest rate of unionization in all of North America. So we're talking about a very highly unionized workforce, to mobilize their members, to get them out to demonstrations, to get them out to actions, but also to do even more than they're already doing to lobby the government against this and other neoliberal policies. So I think the potential is there, but I also think that we're at a moment of polarization as well. Mm. And we need to be careful. We're seeing, for example, the coverage in right-wing media sources is really critical and really negative, and the sort of typical thing you see where the student protesters are basically constructed as terrorists. Practically.
Right. And actually on
the
that,
the electorate is very split right now.
On that note, I want to bring Stephanie back in for a last comment, particularly about the police action. The cost of policing the protests has risen. So now that they're asking for another $35 million for law enforcement operations, and some estimates put the cost of the strike in terms of policing surpassing the cost of the proposed tuition increase. Can you tell us a little bit about the police brutality, some of which we heard on your report?
Yeah, for sure. Well, the excerpt that you played from what I recorded was actually when Jean Charest, the Prime Minister of Quebec, was speaking and hosting the Salon Plan Nord, which is a job fair for this really massive development of the northern part of the Quebec province, which is environmental disastrous and not at all positive for Quebec residents, but very corporate and very, just to the profit of a few rich companies. And so that students protested that because there is that mentality of resisting, the priorities of the government going to things like that instead of education that's accessible and ideally free. And so in instances like that one, riot police were called in massively, and in basically every occupation of buildings that happen, every picket line that happens during every demo, there's a very intense police presence. Universities have also hired security guards that have acted also with violence in some instances. There have been arrests of people who were spied on and arrested in weird circumstances, and many instances of police brutality, who are basically given the orders to just be very antagonistic towards the protesters. During the report that you played, there was a person who was hurt and on the floor, but I also saw somebody get hit to the head and bleeding massively to the head. During the early weeks of the student strike, somebody actually lost an eye to police brutality. And
Stephanie, where can listeners hear your reports, and can you recommend any other news sources? I suppose CKUT is one of the best places for listeners to find out what's happening in Montreal.
Yeah, CKUT, where I work, has been doing a lot of coverage.
Can you give out a website? Can you give out a website?
Yeah, it's cKUT.ca. We do what we call the Red Square Report about the strike, but there's also CUTV, that's Concordia TV, that's been doing really good work. They got some live stream equipment so that they could cover the strike. There's also the Montreal Media Co-op, that's kind of like a citizen journalism website where a lot of people have been posting excellent stuff.
Well, we will link to all of that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today. I want to thank the two of you, Stephanie Claremont, a reporter with CKUT Community Radio, and Lillian Radovic, writer and activist. Very much. Thanks so much for joining us. And Lillian, we'll post your article on uprisingradio.org later today as well. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
Stephanie Claremont, again, a reporter with CKUT Community Radio in Montreal at CKUT.ca. Lillian Radovic, writer, activist, and doctoral candidate at McGill University. We've been talking about the massive student uprising in Montreal now in its 11th week. After this short break, Judy Baca and Estria join us to discuss a new exhibit called Urban Legends happening this Friday.
It's time the peach tree will yield its fruit, and succulents will make its debut. But in time all blossoms will wilt and droop. It's cyclical and there's no recoup.
Come fly with me, drifting so gingerly. A diamond door and with a key, contrive a history.
Time the chicken will fly the coop. Elucidation right next to you. There's a time for work and a time for play. A time for work, but it's not today.
So fly with me.
Cyclical by Jane Collymore. Based here in Los Angeles, more online about her at janecollymore.com, CollyMore.com, or check the featured music section of uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Graffiti art that captures the mood of the day has long played a politically influential role within the city of Los Angeles. Just this past weekend in LA, street artist Norm Maxwell presented his latest series of works, Rising Soul, that included a piece inspired by slain Florida youth Trayvon Martin. The interest in Maxwell's surrealist work, titled Rising Soul, may find its roots in the politically charged art pioneered by LA native and street artist Judy Baca. As a world-renowned Chicana muralist, painter, community arts pioneer, scholar, and educator, Baca uses her art as a vehicle through which to highlight inequality and injustice. Baca founded the first City of Los Angeles mural program in 1974, which she later morphed into the community arts organization known as the Social and Public Art Resource Center, or SPARC, in 1976. Focusing on what is called a new public art, SPARC continues to fund artistic endeavors in marginalized LA communities. It attempts to reach non-traditional audiences, including day laborers, foster youth, and incarcerated adults. Judy Baca is one of the 50-plus featured artists whose work will be celebrated this Friday at the opening for an exhibit entitled Urban Legends, presented by the Estria Foundation, LA Art Machine, SPARC, and other local groups. I spoke recently in studio with Judy Baca, who's also a professor at UCLA, and Estria, a graffiti artist and creative director of the Estria Foundation. Welcome to Uprising, Judy Baca and Estria.
Aloha.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining
us. Nice to be here.
Yeah. We cover art with a social perspective and a social angle on this program a lot. And the work that is being showcased at this Urban Legends public art exhibition very much is in that spirit, because it is to do with public art, with street art, with popular art. I want to begin by asking you, Judy, to tell us a little bit about the context of such an exhibition. And some of the artists, of course, you yourself are featured and your work is featured, but we're at an interesting time in the city with how we as a city view street art. The public and our city officials have different positions on it.
Well, it's a very weird time in Los Angeles, which once was the mural capital of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the demise of so many of the public murals that gave us our particular positionality in the world as a place known for the proliferation of street art. So in the last years, we've had an ordinance, a kind of moratorium on the painting of public, well, not public buildings, but private buildings. So it's been, there's been a loss of the entire funding for the production of new public murals. Our city has moved its money into graffiti abatement. So it's been really about criminalization of the activities on the street.
And Estria, you've been graffitiing for a number of years. You've taught classes in it. What's your take on this?
My take is that what we do, we are modern hieroglyphics. We do something, it's a primal urge. It's old as humanity. And I think that it's only illegal now because it's a sign of the times. Because what we do is older than law.
So tell us about this public art exhibition. It's called Urban Legends, featuring a number of what are called urban artists. And Judy, what are you trying to invoke when you use that term, urban artist?
It's interesting because we've had different terms. We've been called all kinds of things over the years. I mean, working as a muralist for now over 35 years, probably nearly 40, mm-hmm. I've been called a street artist. I've been called a muralist, I think, is part of the
renegade.
Most,
you know, renegade, you know, upstart.
Yes, I think that would be more you than me. But we've had many names, and many of them are not nice. But I think urban legends really does speak to a kind of important moment in which we are creating this coalition between a whole generation, multiple generations, that have found themselves in the same place. The making of public imagery, that belongs to everyone and belongs to no one. And what is really exciting about this exhibition, which I'm honored to be a part of, is that it is both those of us who work in traditional painting and also the spray can artists who have taken on a new form and actually advanced the work in important ways. So it's really all of us, you know, realizing that we have this commonality and understanding that, in a sense, we have become urban legends. Some of us known, some of us not known. People know our marks and they maybe don't know us. But the important thing is that we are artists and that we produce work for the public, and we do it in a free and open way. I mean, there's a kind of incredible belief that art belongs to everyone and every community.
Are there any specific themes that the art is arranged by or that the art is organized around?
For this show, it runs the whole gamut, from things that are silly and light to heavy politics. And we're trying to show that art in public encompasses all of that.
And so tell us about this public art live auction. It's supposed to be the first ever such event to be held in Los Angeles. So what exactly will it look like? I mean, people are familiar with just traditional exhibits, and then there are live auctions to raise money for issues. And usually those auctions are not necessarily of art, but they can be.
Yeah. So I mean, auctions aren't a new thing, but what's new here is it's the first time where we have muralists, you know, traditional muralists from the 70s, and we have graffiti writers from the 80s and 90s and 2000s, and now we have the street artists that are doing the wheat paste and the paintbrush, and it's a whole different thing. So it's exciting for us to be able to show them with those other generations of art in public.
So it's going to be a month-long exhibit.
Yeah.
But then people will also be able to purchase the art?
Yeah, and some of the bigger names in this show are going to be on auction block this Friday evening.
I'm going to be on the auction block.
Wonderful.
The chopping block.
Not me as a person, but some of my actually.
Which
some
of your works will be available?
Well, you know, actually, work that I that we selected from the archives at Spark was the work on the freeway, which is in terrible demise at the moment. My runner on the 4th Street exit of the Harbor Freeway, the 110. Who is running through the wall, a woman runner, which celebrates women in the marathon. So all the working drawings for that, the studies, which I think are, you know, wonderful for people to see, because the amount of work that goes into the production of such a piece that was over 100 feet long and 30 feet high and wow. has sat on the freeway for over 20 years since 1984, more than 20 years, when the Olympics came to Los Angeles. So that work will be available. Okay. And what's interesting about this exhibition is that to have an auction of public art is sort of an anathema. You know, how do you auction public
right.
art?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Yeah. How does, so it's basically the preparatory drawings,
yes,
the work that went into it, the sketches that you made ahead of time.
You get to see inside of the brain of the artist who's thinking about how to design for passing cars at 55 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
who then spent 9 months hanging on the freeway to produce a work like that.
Wonderful. And tell us about some of the other works, Esther, that are available. There are going to be some installations as well as part of this exhibit.
Yeah. Let me just add that having Judy's piece here is a huge honor for me and my whole team, because that's a part of the fabric of the LA identity for the last, 30, 40 years.
There's also going to be many artists who are associated with the hip-hop movement in the exhibit. As well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I guess you'd call us graffiti writers, because what we do is more in relationship with calligraphy than visual arts. And so there are quite a few graffiti artists. They're from, one from Denver, a couple from Hawaii, some from the Bay Area, New York.
And your own work?
I have one of my pieces in there as well, yeah.
What is that piece?
Mine just has like octopus tentacles. It's more of an abstract than anything, but it just kind of captures the essence of the flows of doing graffiti, the movement that you have in it. The challenge for us is to shrink something that's, you know, huge, 40 feet or whatever, down to a couple of feet.
How do you do that? So you're selling prints?
No, I'm just trying to paint smaller.
Oh, so you actually did an original
I did it
work.
In spray paint, yes.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Well, Judy, I want to turn to Spark. In addition to your work as a UCLA professor, you're the founder and artistic director of Spark, the Social and Public Art Resources Center. Tell us about this organization, why it was founded.
Well, in 1974, we were the friends of the first city of Los Angeles mural program. Hmm. And people began very quickly in 1974 when I went before the city council and created the first mural program in Los Angeles. We produced hundreds of works in every ethnic community. We started to give Los Angeles an ethnic face. And these murals very quickly became controversial within the first year because people began to paint about immigration, police, and drug abuse and the kinds of issues that were affecting their communities. So Spark was formulated to become the non-official art program. It couldn't work under the city. It had to be a non-profit. So it began a private and public partnership for the creation of public works in Los Angeles. And we have been the home of the mural programs for Los Angeles for our 35 years. We're in our 35th anniversary. And so Spark was formulated by three women artists who came together to see if we could somehow create work that would be about transforming communities, that would be about social justice, and that we would approach it in varying ways. And that's what we've been doing for all these years. We have a gallery program. We're opening a show this weekend called Uprising as well.
Wonderful. It's a good name.
Well, yes, it's the 20th anniversary of our Uprising in Los Angeles.
Right.
And it's about that. And so we keep up a kind of steady pace of offering opportunities for artists to express the big issues that are occurring in the world we're living in. We've just closed a show called I Can, a Requiem for I Can't, about abuse of women. So Spark has been consistent.
Abuse of women.
Yes, abuse of women who have domestic partners who have mistreated them. And really it's all about recovery, and just a magnificent show done by Windows Between Worlds. So we've been able to consistently offer the space where you could speak to these issues, to the most current issues, to the most difficult issues that people face, and through the arts and in ways that are transformative.
Estria, tell us about the Estria Foundation. You're the creative director there. And how does that sort of fit with the work that Spark is doing?
I look at the work that Spark's done as laying the foundation for folks like us to come along. I mean, you got to imagine how many doors have been closed in their faces in order for them to, for this to even exist, you know? And so,
thank you. That's true.
Nothing but respect. I know what's happened in my own graffiti writing career.
You're talking about the struggles of just having a nonprofit in general, but also
Even just say she wanted to get a wall and she went and asked permission, can we paint on here? And they say no. It's probably happened dozens and dozens of times. I know for myself, it's happened. I get like 1 in 20, and nowadays I get 1 in 2. So we've shifted the mindset of the general public, because now that we've had so many decades of art in public, then people are accustomed to seeing voices on the walls, and it defines who we are as a people, as a community, as a city, what we're thinking. And I think that now allows a lot of these artists to come and do personal statements, so that freedom of speech, maybe it doesn't really exists in the United States, but it definitely exists on the walls. And it's because of people like Judy or Susan Cervantes and these strong women around the country that all run these mural organizations.
So what does Estria do specifically?
So for us, we basically...
Estria Foundation.
Yeah, we basically use art in public as like a bullhorn to draw attention and raise awareness on critical environmental and human issues. So we're doing a series of murals around the world called Water Rights, and it's writing, like graffiti writing.
Uh-huh.
So that's all about basically access to safe drinking water. And then we also throw these graffiti battles around the country, and that kind of rallies together the graffiti writers and gives them a fun thing to participate in, because there's nothing for us. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to start a series of murals in Hawaii on the Hawaiian lyrics of the 70s. which gives us kind of an excuse to talk about how the kingdom was taken over by the United States and how overdevelopment has destroyed the natural resources of the land. So that's going to be a powerful one, too. Mm-hmm. We're also trying to figure out something like an anti-violence without being anti but not being peace, because are you ever going to have peace? You know what I mean? Like, we want to actually attain something. So
the live auction, the public art exhibit and live auction called Urban Legends, that both of you are featured in, that both of your organizations are involved in along with the Mural Conservancy of Los Angeles, that's opening this Friday, April 27th, from 8 to 11 p.m. And there's a VIP opening reception and live auction. It's all happening at the LA Mart and Design Center at 1933 South Broadway in Los Angeles. It's on the 12th floor, suite 1240. And the exhibit goes through the month. There will be, I understand, live music and other things happening on Friday, and then a public opening on Saturday, April 28th at from 7 to 10 p.m. Can people just get tickets online to either of these things?
Yes, they can purchase tickets online at publicartlegends.eventbrite.com.
Publicartlegends.eventbrite, BRITE.com.
Okay. Thank you for saying that. And they can show up at the door, but I don't know what's going to be left by the time they get there.
Yeah,
so they want to buy in advance.
Yeah. The money that'll be raised from this live auction and the exhibit will go towards supporting the work that the two of you do in your organizations.
Yes, so if you buy a piece, half is going to go to the artist, and the other half are going to go to the organizations hosting this, so that we can continue with our programming.
It's very important that we have these kinds of events and that we're able to continue the work, because funding is very difficult at these
times. Of course. Judy Baca is a UCLA professor and founder and artistic director of Spark, online at sparkmurals.org, sparcmurals.org. And Estria is a graffiti artist and creative director of the Estria Foundation, online at estria.org, estria.org. Check uprisingradio.org for all the details for the exhibit. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, George Santayana once said, "An artist is a dreamer consenting to dream of the actual world." That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Chiara Borghetti and Ankur Patel are our interns. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit our website at uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.